Well, today we'll get down to the mechanics of how democratic institutions work, rather than these more general theoretical questions, by focusing on elections. And we'll begin with a pretty simple question: why bother voting? I introduced this last time in discussing free rider problems and the, you know, as a general issue, but let's focus on it more specifically for the question of voting. So here's the problem. In any large election, one vote never makes a difference. The slogan, "every vote counts," is an understandable one. It's an appeal to people to vote what you do matters. But the point is, and it's just a simple mathematical point, what you do matters when you think of what you do as part of a collectivity. What everybody does matters. But it simply isn't the case that one vote decides elections. So what you yourself do on that day isn't going to change the outcome. And there are costs attached to voting. You need to get information about candidates and parties. You have to register. You have to get to the polls. You have to wait in line. Particularly if it's during a work day, it's a bit of a bother. If you have little kids to take care of, there's all sorts of things which make this not trivial. The costs aren't huge in most cases, but they're positive. And if the outcome is zero effects and there are any costs, why do you vote? Since there is zero chance that there is any benefit from your individual act, and since there are real costs, why bother voting? But of course, if most people think this way, few people would vote and democracy would be weakened. And so that's why it's a prisoner's dilemma. So I'm going to pose the question to you. Why do people vote? We'll give this, make this a quick 2-minute discussion with a neighbor. So turn to somebody near you. You can gather in groups of little twos and threes by turning to somebody behind you. Okay, start. Why do people vote? Okay, so let's get some thoughts. Why do people vote? Why do you think? Yeah. So one reason why people vote is that they want their interests protected. But if it doesn't matter whether you vote or not as an individual, why does the fact that you care about your interests, why does that actually get you to vote? That's the puzzle. You know, it does matter what the outcome is, but why bother? Why bother? Why expend the effort? Yeah. You, and then you.
I think that people recognize that if everybody had the idea, okay, like my vote doesn't count, then they would nobody to vote. And I think people recognize that that would be a problem, so they do vote.
So that's an interesting thought that people have, and you're right, people think. If everybody thought that way, then they wouldn't vote. Therefore, I should vote. But still, since whether I do or don't vote isn't going to actually affect what other people think, why should I bother voting anyway? Even if it's true, which it is, that if everybody thought that way, but my action doesn't affect what everybody else thinks. It only affects what I do. So why vote? Okay, that's a really interesting point. You can't be pissed off at a bad outcome if you didn't do your bit. If you didn't do your bit. So this is kind of insurance for being legitimately angry. You know, I want to be able to be angry, and I can't be angry if I didn't do my bit. Well, that could be part of the psychological thinking, although it's a little bit of self-deception there, because it's still the case. Whether or not you voted, the bad outcome would have happened if it is a bad outcome. Yeah.
Some people could feel a sense of patriotism and just general being American and being pro-democracy by voting.
Okay, now I think we're getting to really what ultimately is the core issue. People feel patriotic. I mean, patriotic is one way of talking about this, but and that it wouldn't be, if you're an American, this is what you should do. I think the crucial word is should. The crucial word is should. It only makes sense to vote if you don't make the decision simply on the basis of a cost-benefit calculation. People vote mainly because they see it as a civic obligation or a patriotic obligation would be another way of getting at that same idea. They believe it is wrong to be a free rider on other people's efforts. I'm simply not the kind of person that would care about an outcome in which it depends upon everybody doing their bit and not doing my bit, even if I could get away with it. Even if my own contribution isn't going to decide the outcome. Because I'm the kind of person, my identity is I'm a civically responsible person. I do my duty. It's an obligation. It's part of what it means to be a citizen or an American. You know, there's different code words for basically the same cluster of principles. I think that's really at the heart of the answer. Now, there's some interesting research on these questions, which shows that people also do have a certain kind of self-deception. We're so used to thinking in this kind of cost-benefit analysis, is it worth the effort, that people do kind of deceive themselves by, it's a kind of magical thinking. If I don't vote, then people like me won't vote. And therefore, I should vote because that will somehow or other, this is the little magical black box. If I vote, then people like me, that shows that people like me vote. Of course, that doesn't actually explain why other people like you actually vote, but there is this kind of self-deception. And the slogan, every vote counts, encourages that certain kind of self-deception. Harmless, I think, self-deception. But it misses what's really foundational. You ought to vote. It's your responsibility to vote. It's your responsibility so long as you value democracy. Now, you know, if you're a crypto authoritarian and you really wish that we had a strong military dictatorship in the country, well, then your obligation is to not vote because you don't believe in voting. You know, so I'm not saying that all moral principles should lead you to vote. There are moral reasons to abstain. If you think that a voting process is hopelessly corrupt and that by casting your vote you're contributing to the illusion that we have elections when we don't, that's a reason to have what's called a principled abstention, because you're rejecting that particular election. And in some countries, in some contexts, there's big campaigns to keep people from voting, to say, don't vote. If you vote, you will be legitimating an oppressive regime that's using this vote as a phony way of maintaining power. Either because the ballots are stuffed, you know, the ballots aren't really being counted, or because it's rigged in other ways so as to justify an authoritarian regime rather than as an expression of democracy. Well, this is right, if it's some combination of moral concern and the costs of voting, so, you know, people can feel an obligation to vote, but if you raise the costs tremendously, if you make it really hard to vote, then even if you feel it's your duty, you might not do it. So people are complicated. They combine a sense of moral obligation with the costs and benefits. But the costs and benefits cease to be the costs and benefits of how much of a difference your vote will make. It's the costs of acting morally. So just to take an extreme case, there are places in the world where you risk your life to vote. There's significant violence at the voting place. Well, that enormously raises the cost of voting, but it's the cost balanced against the moral obligation, not the cost of voting balanced against the chance that your vote will make a difference. It's the cost of acting in a moral way. So there are two big issues in play here. There's that explain variations in voting and how much people vote. There's variations in the barriers and costs to voting. Even among the established liberal democracies where you don't risk your life to vote, there's huge variations across countries in how difficult it is to vote. And there's variations over time. And there's variations, of course, in the sense of civic obligation. Well, let's look at some data comparing the United States to other countries and the United States over time. And then we'll look at this problem of costs and barriers to voting and the sense of civic obligation. Okay, so here is average voter turnout in national elections for the lower legislative house. So this would be for the House of Representatives in the United States, because that's comparable to parliament in other countries. And this is the average voter turnout in years when it's not also a presidential election. So voter turnout is higher when there's a presidential election, a truly comparable measure to voting for Congress is voting on the off years, on the elections that are not coinciding with a presidential election. And as you see, the United States is the lowest of the bunch. There's no other liberal democracy. By liberal democracy, I'm not using the word liberal as in the American sense of liberal versus conservative. I just mean a democracy that has the full civil rights and ordinary liberties we associate with a democratic society. In some countries, the average voter turnout is in the 80% range. In most, it's in the 60+ to 70% range. In the United States, the average voter turnout in national elections between 1945 and 2013 was under 50%. Here is voter turnout over time in the United States for presidential elections and off-year congressional elections. And as you can see, for congressional elections, it's been declining. It's now under 40%, typically. And even in presidential elections, the voter rate hovers around 55%, sometimes dipping below 50%. That means even in a presidential election, almost half of the adult population don't bother voting. Only half of the citizens in the United States, roughly speaking, consider it worthwhile to take the time and effort to vote. Well, how do we explain this? How does U.S. social conditions and political institutions undermine voting? First, the cost of voting. We have pretty cumbersome registration rules. In many countries, it's automatic. Every adult citizen is automatically registered. You don't have to do anything to register. It's just an automatic feature of being a citizen that you are registered to vote. We have added new rules to voter registration. Most notoriously, in the last decade or so, photo ID requirements. The photo ID requirements have been justified on the grounds that it prevents fraud in voting. That is, people who are not entitled to vote, they're not citizens, for example, showing up and voting. Well, that's almost universally, by people who study this, regarded as a completely phony justification, because in fact there is virtually no voter fraud in the United States. It's just exceptionally rare that people illegally vote. And more often than not, when it happens, it turns out to be a mistake of some sort rather than any effort at fraudulent behavior. Photo IDs were introduced specifically for the purpose of reducing voting, to make it harder for people to vote. The voter ID laws are deliberately designed to suppress voting, particularly of people who don't have a voter ID as an automatic consequence of something else they do. Well, what's the most common way of getting a voter ID? Having a driver's license. In the American population, what are the categories of people who are least likely to have driver's licenses? People who don't own cars. Who are the people most likely not to own cars? Poor people, minorities. And young people. You know, the proportion of you that own cars is lower than the proportion in the population above 30, right? So if students and poor people and minority people disproportionately vote for one particular party in the United States, they disproportionately vote Democratic, and you are a Republican legislature and you want to reduce the votes for the opposition party, what better way to do it than to introduce a rule that says, if you don't have a driver's license, you have to, and therefore don't have a car, you have to get yourself to a Department of Motor Vehicle office, wait in line for an hour or so, and get a voter ID card. That's a big cost. That's saying that in order to vote, you have to go to all that trouble. Well, many people still do it, but as you can see, it reduces voting, makes it more costly. Some people have argued that the 20,000 vote difference in Wisconsin in the last election between the Democratic and Republican candidates for president, 20,000 vote margin is pretty small. The voter turnout among minorities and poorer people dropped between 2000 and 2016 by much, much more than 20,000 votes. And at least part of that was due to the imposition of a voter photo ID requirement. Okay. In addition to the cost of voting, consumerism, individualism, privatism as a way of thinking your private life is what matters, you don't have serious civic obligation, these undermine the values of collective institutions, including democracy. The slogan, the government is the problem, not the solution to the problem. The idea that the government is there to oppress you, all of this undermines a sense of civic obligation. Consumerism is all about shopping, about individual private consumption, not about your responsibilities and obligations to the broader community. The constant attack on the affirmative state, we'll discuss this in next week's lecture, the attack on the affirmative state undermines people's identification with government and their belief in politics. High levels of inequality. erode a sense of community and a sense of civic obligation. One of the things that underwrites civic obligation is the sense that we're all in this together. You know, if we're all in this together, if we're in a common, we share a common fate and we have institutions in order to manage our collective common fate, that increases a person's identification with the responsibilities that come with that common fate, civic obligation. High levels of inequality of the sort that we've observed in the United States and have become increasingly serious over the last few decades, as we discussed in the earlier part of the course, that erodes a sense of commonality. And finally, the role of money in politics makes many people feel cynical about participation. It makes people believe that the democratic process, in spite of the formal equality of citizens, one person, one vote, actually has a kind of corrupt undertone to it. There's a shadow of corruption around democratic politics because of the role of money in politics. And this breeds cynicism. And cynicism breeds apathy. Cynicism breeds resignation. Why bother? Why bother voting, therefore? Why bother to vote if you believe that the game is really rigged by money, that money is determining politics rather than citizens? That undermines the sense that the process of democracy is one to be respected and one to which one owes obligations. Well, let's now turn to the rules of the game. This is a pretty interesting topic. If those of you who have taken political science courses probably have encountered some of this. This is one of these simple cases of an absolutely fundamental idea in sociology, which we started the course with. That sociology, at least one way of thinking about sociology, is the study of the rules that govern social life. And sometimes these rules really do look like rules. They're just in the ordinary sense. They're rules of the game, how you play the game. And elections have this interesting property that there are around the world many different ways of doing it. There are many different rules. So it's a kind of natural experiment. We can see what happens in a political system when you have one set of rules and when you have another. And it's also a really fertile ground for thinking about new kinds of rules. You know, if you could snap your fingers and create a different set of electoral rules, what would they be? And what would be the consequences? Well, this is one of the favorite sports of political scientists. They do computer simulations of electoral outcomes under different rules of the game. And you can do it because the rules are specified quite precisely. So what I want to do now is I will discuss the rules of the American game, the rules of electoral competition and representation in particular, and show how they work. And then I will present a couple of alternative rules, which arguably would make the democratic process more democratic. So first, the basic structure of the US system. The US system is called a single member district with plurality voting system. Single member district with plurality voting. That's the technical term for how we organize nearly all of our elections, or what is also called first past the post single member districts. That is, in an election, whoever gets the most votes wins. Now, we have this very peculiar twist to this in presidential elections. As we know, in the last election, Trump got 3 million votes less than Clinton and still won. That's weird. How can you get fewer votes and win in a one-person, one-vote democracy? Well, it's because we have this very peculiar system called the Electoral College, in which when you vote for president, you're not actually voting for the president. You're voting for electors in your state. And each state allocates its electors on a first past the post basis. Whichever candidate gets the most votes in the state gets all of the electors. But since the allocation of electors to states is not strictly proportional to population, it can happen that you can win a majority of the electors nationally and still have fewer votes in total. And that's what happened in this last election. So I'm not going to discuss that. I'm going to discuss ordinary elections, elections for governor, elections for state assembly and representatives. So here's what this first past the post single member district means. You could have three candidates. One gets 34% of the vote. The other two get 32% of the vote. Right? Three candidates running an election. One gets 34%. The other two each get 32. The first candidate is elected, even though that candidate got just over a third of the votes in the district. Whichever, that's plurality voting. Whoever gets the most votes wins. And there's only one representative per district. The consequence is what's called a two-party duopoly. Duopoly just means a two-party system. Because people fear of wasting votes on a third party. This is a common problem. If you have three candidates and you really like the third, the candidate that's the least likely to win, that candidate corresponds to your values and your principles, and the other two you don't like, but you hate one of them really bad. One you think is terrible, the other just bad. So you decide to vote for the lesser of two evils. That's the common expression used in this kind of electoral system, first past the post. There's three candidates, one you like, two you dislike, but one you really dislike. You decide to vote for the lesser two evils because you're worried about wasting your vote, throwing away your vote. And you're only throwing away your vote because whoever gets the most votes wins. The winner does not have to win a majority of votes. They just have to get more. In the past, there was a particular type of voting in the 19th century that was allowed throughout the United States that helped to get around the lesser of two evils problem. That is, you could have a given candidate that could run on two party lines on a ballot. Two parties could nominate the same candidate so that the candidate could appear on the ballot more than once under different party lines. The most famous case of this was the Populist Party in the late 19th century, in which populist candidates ran both as populists and as Democrats, and you could vote for them under either line. In New York, this is still allowed, and New York has the strongest third-party presence in the United States, because you're not wasting your vote. If an acceptable candidate by the major party, or if the third-party candidate is acceptable to the major party, then two parties can endorse the same candidate. This still exists in New York. After the 1896 election, in which the populists did so well because of this procedure, this kind of voting, which was called fusion voting, was made illegal throughout most of the United States. It used to be present in Wisconsin. It's now illegal in Wisconsin. So first past the post, single member districts, that kind of voting system squeezes out third parties. It makes it very difficult, if you don't like either of the major parties, to organize a political opposition. There are, however, other voting rules, and I'm going to discuss a few of them with you. These are alternative voting rules that might increase the democraticness of elections. The most common is what's called proportional representation. Proportional representation. There are many different varieties of it, but the basic principle is that you get the number of delegates in the House of Representatives, in the Legislative Assembly, proportional to the number of votes that each party gets. This requires that the districts have more than one candidate, more than one representative. You need multi-member districts rather than single-member districts. Or you need a kind of top-up at-large system. So you could have, for example, in Wisconsin, let's say you had 50 legislative districts, each of which was first past the post, but then you had another 50 at-large delegates that would be allocated proportionately to the total vote in the state for each party. You know, so you'd have a combination of district candidates and at-large candidates so that the legislature in the end proportionally represented the votes for particular parties. That would mean you wouldn't be wasting your vote when you voted for a third party candidate. Another kind of system is still first past the post, still single member districts, but it's called instant runoff voting. You rank order the candidates on the ballot when you vote. And this is an illustration of how that would work. You rank order your candidates A, B, and C in the first round, and then you rank your second choices also across these three parties. And in some systems, you could rank, you could have third choices and so on. Depends on how many parties are running. So in this particular example, in the first round, candidate A got the least votes. And so candidate A would be eliminated, and the second and third choices of the voters of candidate A would be allocated to candidates B and C. So in the first round, if it was a first past the post election, candidate C would have won with 2,200 votes. But when we eliminate candidate A and redistribute votes to candidates B and C, it ends up that candidate B ends up with more votes. In the first round, candidate B got 35% of the votes. In the second round, it gets 60% of first round votes for B and second choice, first rank votes for B, and the second rank choice from the voters of candidate A. So in an instant runoff voting system, which is a slight modification of first past the post, that is, you still have one member in a district, and it's still only one person that gets elected, but you allow people to express their second preference. Now, that kind of system would enormously benefit in the United States both the Libertarian Party on the conservative side of the spectrum and the Green Party on the liberal side of the spectrum. Many more people would vote for Libertarian first and Republican second. And many more people would vote for Green Party first and Democratic Party second. And depending upon how it worked, it could be a sufficiently greater number of people would vote for these now excluded parties that they would actually get representatives elected under an instant runoff vote. People would not fear wasting their votes, so they wouldn't just vote for the lesser of two evils. There's one more idea for an alternative way of imagining elections taking place that I think is extremely attractive. It's not been adopted anywhere, although it's being discussed a little bit in some places. It's called proxy voter representation. And here's the idea. All the candidates who get above a particular threshold, let's say for the moment 20% of the vote, any candidate who gets above 20% of the vote gets elected. It means you can have multiple people elected from a single district. Anyone who gets above 20% gets elected. The second preferences of votes of excluded candidates, so some candidates won't get 20%, their second preferences, those votes get redistributed to the elected candidates. And then, and here's the kicker, here's the thing that really is distinctive. When those legislatures sit in the assembly and cast votes on bills, they cast the number of votes they received in the election. If you're a candidate, so here's an example. We got four candidates. nice round number of voters, 100,000 votes. In the first round, candidate A got 35% of the vote, candidate B 30%, candidate C 20%, and candidate D 15%. So candidate D is excluded, and the votes, the second preference votes of candidate D are then redistributed to A, B, and C. A, B, and C all go and sit in the state legislature. And when they vote, they cast the total number of votes that they actually received. Candidate A received 35,000 votes as the first choice and no votes from candidate D. So that candidate casts 35,000 votes in the assembly. Candidate B got 30,000 votes directly and then got 12,000 votes as the second choice of the voters who voted for D. That candidate, when a bill is up for vote, casts 42,000 votes. And candidate C casts 23,000. So what's going on here? This seems kind of wild. First of all, logistically it's simple with computers and the like. It's no problem that when you press the button to say, yes, I'm voting for this, that 40,000 votes get registered in the tally for the legislature. What it means is that the representative is casting the votes of the voters who voted for that person. It strengthens the sense in which that representative is your representative. What you've done is given that representative your vote and have said to him, I trust you to cast my vote for bills, for laws. You're casting my vote. That means I can hold you more accountable in a kind of moral sense. I've given you my vote to cast. It also means that the candidate's voting power within the legislature directly reflects their popular support. How many voters have confidence in them casting their vote in the legislature? It also means it's completely impossible to gerrymander districts. We'll discuss gerrymandering in a moment. Doesn't matter how you draw the district boundaries. If you draw them in such a way so that you're going to pack all the Democratic votes or all the Republican votes in a single district to really overload it, well, that just means that that representative is going to have that many more votes to cast in the legislature. In effect, gerrymandering will have the perverse consequence of increasing the power of people who are elected from a district that has packed all the voters of a particular party in one place. Those legislators will be super powerful because they'll have so many votes to cast in the legislature. I'm a big fan of this proxy voter representation idea. I think it strengthens the symbolic character of the democratic process because of the way in which the voters are the real source of power, and their representatives are acting on their behalf as representatives who cast their votes. It's not been instituted anywhere. I don't see any reason in principle why it can't be. And if there is an upsurge in the next decades of a desire to strengthen and deepen democracy, I think this is one of the ideas that will be on the table for how we could do that, how we could make democracy more democratic. All right, next topic, electoral districts. The big issue, and one of the big issues in American politics, gerrymandering. So just to illustrate, this is just a made-up example. Let's suppose we had an electoral system with three districts, a total of 6.3 million voters. And we drew the district boundaries in this really strange way, so that half of the 4 million Democratic voters were in a single district, and the other half were evenly distributed between the second and third district. Whereas among Republican voters, only a small percentage were in this first district, and the others were evenly distributed across districts 2 and 3. Well, in this totally contrived example, you could have an electorate in which 63% of the voters were Democratic, but only 33% of the elected representatives were Democratic. You can see that since in each district, whoever gets the most vote wins, District 1, in effect, concentrates the Democratic vote all in one particular district, in a way that therefore means that the Democratic votes are, quote, wasted. They're redundant. There's too many of them going to a single candidate. But those voters don't have the ability to cast their vote for other representatives in other districts because it's single-member district, first past the post. The strategies of gerrymandering are referred to as packing and cracking, right? You want to divide up the voters between districts in such a way that you pack as many as possible in one district from one party, and then disperse the others in such a way that they are a smaller majority in a bunch of other districts. So this is just a visual illustration of how packing and cracking would work. This is also in the chapter in the book. Here's just some pictures of pretty wild districts. I mean, if you want to draw electoral districts in order to pack all the voters of the opposition party into one district, these days with computer-aided mapping techniques, it's pretty easy to draw really fanciful districts. You know, look at the Texas 35th is one of the notorious examples. The Texas Republican Party gerrymandered the Texas districts in a kind of relentlessly systematic way. Wisconsin has done a pretty good job too. Pennsylvania is really extraordinary in how it's done it. But look at this Texas district. It stretches from Austin to San Antonio, and it has this really narrow strip that goes down to connect these two areas. And it does so in order to pack as many Democratic voters into this odd-shaped district as possible. And then you get these things like this Baltimore-Maryland 3rd District, where, you know, some parts of the district are connected by a single street, you know, that will connect two globs that will have concentrations of particular voters. I don't have data from the last election, but from the 2012 election, in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania, there were a majority of votes for Democratic congressional candidates, and yet in both states, a majority of the seats went to Republicans. In Pennsylvania, this was particularly egregious. They have 18 congressional seats, 13 of them went to Republicans, 13 out of 18, even though in the state, a majority of voters voted for Democrats. The Democrats won their districts by an average in Pennsylvania, by an average of 52 percentage points. You know, basically winning 75 to 25. 75% for the Democrats, 25%. Huge majorities, primarily, of course, in, as you would expect, in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, in the big cities. High concentrations of Democratic voters. Whereas in Republican districts, they won by an average of 18%. And that's exactly what you want to do if you want to gerrymander. If you want to maximize the number of seats that a particular party wins, you try to spread out those voters as evenly as possible with just a modest majority across as many districts as possible. In the 13 districts that Republicans won, they won by 18%. In the 5 districts that Democrats won, they won by 52%. And this then illustrates the distortions that this creates. These are the number of votes it takes to elect a Democratic House member compared to a Republican House member because of the way the votes are distributed. That's gerrymandering. Gerrymandering in the 2010 election made a significant difference in the 2012 election. One of the reasons why there is a robust and durable majority in the U.S. Congress, in the House of Representatives, is because of the number of seats which have been jerry-rigged, in which the boundaries have been organized in this way. Now, it's important to note that there's really two kinds of intersecting problems here. There's what is sometimes called natural gerrymandering. The fact that urban centers are much more heavily concentrated with Democratic voters than suburban and rural areas are, that there's all this concentration of high-density populations that are much more dominantly Democratic in the cities than the more dispersed populations in the countryside. That's not gerrymandering in the sense of some artificial boundary being drawn, but it still has the effect of concentrating the voters for one party in particular geographical spaces, so that a first-past-the-post single-member district system will be biased against that party. So that's sometimes called natural gerrymandering. And then there's the artificial gerrymandering that comes from political parties having the power in some states, but not all, to draw the boundaries. There are states in the United States where they have commissions, nonpartisan commissions, that draw the boundaries of electoral districts that prevent political parties from doing it to their own advantage. In Wisconsin, this is completely controlled by the state legislature and the governor. Money and politics. Money and politics. Well, gerrymandering matters. It affects the outcomes of elections. It affects the distribution of parties in the elected chambers. The rules of the game matter. Single-member districts create this duopoly of two parties, make it harder for third parties to have a role. All of these things are important for the way American democracy actually works. But there's an additional issue which has become increasingly severe and which I think even more fundamentally erodes the democratic ideals and makes the actual institutions more and more distant from what could be really called an effective democracy. And that's the role of money in politics. There are two core issues in play here. First is lobbying. Legislators are often not particularly well informed about lots of issues, understandably. They have limited staffs to work out policies, to acquire information. Well-funded lobbyists provide vast amounts of information to politicians and government officials. And as one might imagine, the quality of such information in terms of its accuracy, its biases, its extent in which it doesn't report certain information that wouldn't be advantageous to its cause, you can imagine that lobbyists provide what I think could be called, in general, highly biased information. And if all lobbyists of all sides had equal resources to devote to this, well, perhaps that wouldn't be quite so serious a problem. It still would be. I mean, after all, it's not the case that getting a lot of bad information from different sides of an issue doesn't make for good information. Right? It still is, you know, two biases don't make a correct view. But it would be better than the current situation in which it's well-funded lobbyists that provide the vast majority of information and pressure on government officials. And secondly, and this has gotten much more attention than the first, campaign finance. It costs an enormous amount to run for national public office. It's not cheap. And almost always the candidate with the most money wins. Does this undermine the equality of citizens in a democracy? Well, I think it does. The principle of democracy is equal citizens expressing their will through a democratic process. But if some citizens have a capacity to influence the outcome of elections more than others by virtue of the resources they can, from the private resources they can deploy politically, that undermines this foundational idea of equality of citizens. In the American context, this problem is especially difficult because of the legal rules that have been that have developed over the years, particularly through the Supreme Court, around the issue of regulating campaign finance. The most recent of these rules came out of a court decision that's referred to as Citizens United, in which the court ruled that corporations should be thought of as legal persons. And thus, the principles of freedom of speech apply to corporations, not just to real persons. It applies to corporate persons. And therefore, to put any restrictions on the amount of money that corporations can spend on elections, to put any restrictions on that, would be a violation of the free speech rights of corporations. So just as you are allowed to spend, if you're a billionaire, you could spend $10 million on ads during a political season advocating for certain positions because that's part of your rights as a citizen, as a person, and your right of free speech gives you the right to spend money on speech. The Supreme Court ruled that corporations were just like that. You know, my view is that if corporations are persons and they break the law, then the corporation should go to jail, right? Well, of course, that's ridiculous. We know that corporations can commit terrible crimes all the time. They can break the law in ways in which if an individual did the same thing, they would go to jail. But what does it mean to put a corporation in jail? You can't do it. What you can do is put certain executives in jail, but it's often easier to show that a corporation committed a crime than to know which person within the corporation actually made the decisions and did the things which were criminal. In any case, once the Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United that corporations were persons and that they could spend unlimited amounts of money on political campaigns, that just opened the floodgates for an enormous escalation in the amount of money that flowed into political campaigns, particularly in the form of what are called PACs, political action committees, which mobilize resources not directly to give to a candidate, but to run ads, typically that's the main thing that is done, on behalf of particular political positions. And in particular, PACs engage in the worst forms of attack ads to discredit candidates by pouring masses of money into television ads that ridicule and smear candidates for election. And it's mostly, most of the PAC money comes from rich and powerful individuals and now corporations. As the result of this, the government cannot restrict the following. In the United States, the government can't restrict candidates' spending from their own pockets. It can't control the overall level of spending. It cannot put any constraints on independent expenditures on issue ads. It can't put any restrictions on corporation spending on independent ads for candidates, so long as those ads are not coordinated with the campaign, the candidate's own campaign officials. The only real limits are on direct contributions to candidates, but there are ways to get around that as well. The consequences of this are that candidates without strong financial networks or personal fortunes cannot run for office. The Senate is filled with millionaires. It's filled with millionaires both because it enables candidates to spend their own money for election. Herbert Cole used to run on the campaign slogan, "I'm nobody's candidate but yours," because he was so rich that he could finance his campaigns entirely out of his own pocket and do so without ever noticing that it cost him anything. That is, it did not reduce his consumption level by one penny. He had sufficient discretionary income that he could finance his own campaign. The Senate is filled with millionaires, partially because they can pay for part of their campaigns themselves, but also being a millionaire puts you into connections through networks with other very wealthy people and organizations. Candidates get the vast proportion of their money from wealthy individuals and corporations. In 2008, only 1% of adult population contributed 200 or more to political campaigns. And there's a strong correlation between the votes of politicians and their sources of funding. A notorious example is the 213 members of Congress who voted to spend $500 million more on the B-2 stealth bombers received an average of $2,100 from the contractor. The 210 who voted against it got only $100. Now, this does not prove a quid pro quo. This doesn't prove direct corruption in the sense that somebody from the contractor's office went to the congressman and said, look, if you vote for this, I will give you $50,000 for your campaign. That's quid pro quo. That's a direct deal. The fact that there's this disproportionate funding doesn't prove it's at that level of crudeness. What it does support is the view that if you want large campaign contributions, it's better to be favorable to the interests of the sources of large campaign contributions, which are primarily wealthy individuals and corporations. Well, are there solutions? I will look briefly in the remaining time at four possible solutions to this problem of campaign finance. The first is what could be called the patchwork option. This is to keep adding targeted restrictions and provisions. In the early 2000s, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform was an example. The Citizens United Supreme Court decision undermined that solution. The McCain-Feingold compromise, which was a bipartisan campaign finance control act, was part of it was ruled unconstitutional in Citizens United. Given Citizens United, the patchwork option, the main patchwork option that's currently being discussed is the idea that, okay, we can't regulate the amount of money that goes into a political action campaign or into these attack ads, but maybe we can require that all campaign ads and attack ads, they have to release the names of their contributors. Maybe if we knew which corporations were paying for which ads, that would act as a kind of constraint on the corporations because they might be hesitant to risk their brand by being too closely identified with particular political positions. That's called campaign finance disclosure. Well, that's been feverishly opposed by conservative political forces. It probably would survive a Supreme Court test. It doesn't seem that free speech requires anonymity. That the idea that corporations not only are persons, but they have the right to remain anonymous, that seems a bit of a stretch, but of course the Supreme Court can do what it wants. A second solution is direct public financing. This is sometimes referred to as the Clean Elections Act. This has been done in a few states. Maine has a Clean Elections Act, as does Arizona. And here's the basic structure. Candidates who participate agree to accept only public financing. So you're either in or out. If you accept public financing to qualify, you need to get a specified number of very small contributions. So I don't know what the figures are, but let's suppose it is. You need to get 5,000 $5 contributions to show that you have at least some base of support for the election. But they're small contributions from ordinary people. There also are some special provisions for startup funds if you really have no resources to even do the campaign to get the $5 contributions. There's no matching funds. All candidates get the same. So it's not that the state matches private donations. Anybody who's in the public finance system gets the same amount of money. And then, and this is an interesting position. If a clean election candidate for the state legislature is running against somebody who is privately funded, then the clean election candidate gets supplementary funds to make the competition fair. This has the effect of basically driving out private money. It doesn't pay to put in a lot of private money because it doesn't give you the same kind of advantage. Here's another idea. This is developed by a Yale law professor named Bruce Ackerman. It's called the democracy card. He calls it the patriot card, but I think it's more accurately described as a democracy card. Here's the idea. Every registered voter, just as an example, would get $50 in a political credit card, basically a debit card, when they register to vote. So when you register to vote, you get this plastic card that has $50 on it that can be used to make contributions to any political candidate or organization. With 130 million registered voters, this comes to something like $6.5 billion per year for all elections. So the federal government would say, we are going to provide $6.5 billion of funding for elections, for politicians, for democracy, but voters get to allocate it. The government doesn't allocate the money, it just provides the money. Citizens allocate these $50 chunks that they all have. If a candidate gets any private contributions, they can't use any of the democracy money. So candidates have to make a choice. Are they going to run as privately funded politicians, or are they going to get citizens' dollars, these democracy dollars from the democracy card from citizens? There is no limit to how much money a candidate can get through the democracy card donations. But note, the democracy card itself is allocating money on an egalitarian basis. Instead of it being $1, one vote, the candidate's first campaign for democracy dollars on an egalitarian basis, because every citizen has the same amount of money to offer. And then using the money from the democracy cards runs the direct election campaign for based on equality of citizens. So that's a really interesting proposal, and it's a proposal that is consistent with Citizens United, with the Supreme Court decision that doesn't restrict private spending on politics. It attempts to swap politics with public money, but the public money is allocated on an equal basis by citizens. So it's consistent with the equal citizen idea of democracy, but it applies the equal citizen idea both to the allocation of resources for political campaigns and the allocation of votes in the actual voting process. Well, here's an even wilder idea. It's called a randomly selected citizens assembly. So here's the proposal. Replace one elected legislative chamber with a chamber of randomly selected citizens. I mentioned this in the last lecture. This is called, the people who write about this and think about alternative institutions, this is called a sortition legislature. So we have a bicameral system, two chambers in Wisconsin, we have a state assembly and a state senate. What's the point of having two chambers? They're both based on districts. They're both elected by parties. What's the point of two chambers? Let's get rid of one of them and replace it with a citizens assembly. But a citizens assembly that is filled not by elections, but the same way that a jury is filled. Random selection of legislators. The sortition chamber has equal power to the elected chamber, just like the Senate does to the Assembly. Legislation can be initiated in either chamber. Citizen legislators, for example, could serve four-year terms, with 25% being replaced each year. And let's assume, for purposes of making this an attractive model, that they're very well paid. Just as an example, The citizen legislators could be paid twice the median income of the state. So that would put them, the salaries of the citizen legislators, in the top 10 or 15% of the income distribution. That makes it a very attractive job for most people. You know, it's a pretty attractive job for most people to get up into the top 10 or 15%. It isn't a particularly attractive job for very wealthy. So if anything, this citizen's chamber is biased, since you can say no. You're not conscripted for it. You're just randomly chosen. If anything, it's biased towards ordinary citizens, not towards elites. The citizen legislators would have a period of training before they would take their seats, and they'd have a very strong professional civil service staff to provide guidance in their discussions, to help with technical details and the preparation of legislation, doing at least some of the things that political parties typically do for the elected chamber. So then you have two chambers, one elected in the ordinary way, organized by parties. I would like the elected chamber to be done with my proxy voting, so it's a more democratic elected chamber, but still, it's a party-elected professional politicians' chamber and a citizens' chamber. And then they engage in interaction in terms of passing legislature. The citizens' chamber acts as a kind of jury on whether the bills that are proposed by the elected chamber actually represent the interests of the population of the state. The elected chamber acts as a more ideologically and programmatic source of legislation than is likely from the citizens' chamber. The two chambers would then complement each other, reflecting different problems and different solutions within a democratic system. I think the idea of a randomly selected citizens' assembly is an extremely interesting way of thinking about how we could make democracy more democratic. One could imagine in Great Britain some big crisis of democracy in the next decades in which the House of Lords, which used to be a hereditary political chamber and has become a house of notables. The legislators who sit in the House of Lords are appointed by prime ministers. One could imagine a reform proposal which says, let's get rid of the House of Lords and replace it with a really representative institution, a sortition chamber. So one could imagine in a place like Great Britain having a project which would create this model. And there is some discussion actually in Britain about the desirability of turning the House of Lords into a randomly selected citizens' assembly. On Tuesday, we will turn to what might seem like a boring topic, taxation, but actually how we organize our resources for democratic processes is fundamental. See you then.